I was the nerdiest kid with the synopsis. Like, the Oregon hunting synopsis came out, and I would read that cover to cover. Like, that's how much of a nerd I was. Everyone wants to go build the attic before they pour the foundation, and it's like, you have to have these, like, lots and lots of experiences. You have to screw up. You're not going to go in there and be a great elk hunter right out the gate. Stop hunting Washington. Like, you're trying to become a pro NASCAR driver with, like, a moped. First number one plan is go as hard and fast as you can until you find some elk to actually hunt, and then we can slow it down. Hey, guys, this is Cody Rich with the Rich Outdoors Podcast, and you're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
Our culture needs people that are leaders and not people that are waiting for somebody else to show them how to do it.
Those fields of tofu, that was formerly habitat for wildlife. You're killing off wildlife by being a vegetarian just as much as a hunter when he kills a deer.
I'm like, well, you see that bush right there? There's your bathroom.
Yeah. My dad wears a Levi jacket. He sits in front of a sagebrush and he tells me the best camo is hold still.
Not to Donnie Vincent this, but be relentless in everything you do. Don't crap out. Go back to the truck with excuses or whatever.
Okay, assume I get a deer. How do I cut it up to fit into a Honda Civic?
Just get outside. Just get outside and go. Because once you do, it's all gravy from there.
Hey, this is Zach Griffith.
This is Hannah Barron.
This is Jason Phelps of Phelps Game Calls.
Hey, guys, this is Cody Rich from the Rich Outdoors Podcast.
What's up, guys? This is Chad Mendez.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. All right, y'all, so getting on to today's episode. Y'all, he is back since, I think we recorded, yours was one of the very last episodes I released right before my first hunt. It was like the thoughts to remember when you're on your way to it was like my first Q&A podcast too. I had people submit questions and all that stuff. And nice. But yeah, man, it's been a while since we chatted.
What episode are you on now?
This will probably be like 187.
Dang.
But then, you know, I got a handful of bonus episodes. I've got all those conservation episodes, which I need to do those again. Those were huge. And then life got in the way and I'm like scrambling to barely release one a week.
Yeah. So are you finding it easier or harder at this point to like keep producing episodes once a week, all that stuff?
It's honestly, I feel like it's easier to produce better quality episodes easier, but I've stepped up the quality. So like the level of difficulty is kind of balanced out. And I mean, and I've got a team, you know, I run my marketing agency, so I've got a team now, and when they're not working on client stuff, I make them
do your stuff,
do my bitch work on the podcast.
Yeah.
And I know Josh is listening to this. So, they do a fantastic job helping me out. And, I still take on a lot of the podcast myself. You know, I edit all the covers, and that's one thing that I need to learn to let go of. But that's also, there's probably, I'm sure, stuff you work on specifically on the podcast that you enjoy because it's still your baby and your passion.
I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but there are a lot of things that I do. We actually have this conversation in January, early this month, about how there are things I should probably let go of. And stop working on, I should say. It's not the minutiae, I would say, but like just there's like things like you to be scalable. It's like, okay, I need to take some of the things off my plate. Just like as you get busier, like there's so many things on your plate, and then January is a good time for me to reevaluate. Like, okay, am I making the most of my time? Am I doing, you know, what's the 80-20? I'm always big on that.
Well, and my whole thing is okay, I love editing the covers. I'm very specific how I like them done. And
yeah,
but that's also something I can give someone feedback for. This is not like high level design work here. It's cropping out pictures and updating text. And it's like, okay, is my time best spent doing that? Or if I can release an extra episode a week or reach out to people or actually research a potential guest before I start talking to them. Yeah. That might be amazing to do for, I think I've done that three times in the entirety of my podcast.
That's funny. I'm pretty bad about that. But also I feel like the more background I have on a cast, the more scripted the podcast sounds. Like if I go into one just kind of riffing with a couple broad ideas, I do better than if I'm like, okay, here's exactly what the layout's going to look like and how we're going to, like, I used to do that. I used to have like, here's all the questions and like, this would be a great interview. And then it would just like, it wouldn't, it would just sound scripted. You know? Feels, and I listen to podcasts like that all the time where I'm like, oh man, this just sounds like they had a list of questions.
And I never want to get there, but it is nice to have some background on, and honestly, most of the people I interview, I've been following for a while. I know who they are. And so I do know them. And I guess I don't give myself enough credit that way.
Yeah.
But then I listen to, like, you know, we both know Brad Luttrell. Mm. And he, that dude will like call your third grade teacher to get background. I feel background info on you.
Oh, it's so funny. He's so organized. He's like, we scheduled a podcast. It was like 3 months out. I'm like, dude, he's like, hey, does this date work for you? I'm like, I have no idea. Like, who plans 3 months ahead? You're like, hey, do you have time for a meeting? Like, we'll schedule a meeting. Cause we talk quite a bit. Cause we both sit on the board for Raise My Doors. And so we'll schedule a meeting and it'll be like a month and a half out. He's like, hey, does 2 o'clock on the 13th work for you? I'm like, sure. I'm still trying to plan this week, bro. Like, yeah.
Well, so I just realized I never actually introduced you. So I guess if you guys weren't paying attention in the intro, and you don't recognize this manly, beautiful voice.
I hate my voice.
how many episodes was it before you could actually listen to a podcast?
I still can't. I still can't do it.
I feel like I sound like such an idiot. And every, like, I'm like, my laugh is weird and I say weird things.
I can't do it. One of my friends was in to do a podcast, Shannon, she works over here. And she's like, she turned on the podcast. I was like, I don't want to listen. Like, no, don't. I don't want to listen to my own voice. Like, I don't want to. No, I still can't do it. So, yeah. Anyway, we're, I run a podcast. We're 500 plus some-ish deep in episodes, which is really not even, it's probably a heck of a lot more. There's so many that aren't numbered or titled or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've been doing it a while.
And I will say, you were one of the first podcasts I started listening to and were a big inspiration for me starting this.
That's
and,
awesome.
I remember back in the day, like, I mean, when I first started, you know, I posted up, it was just like a little Instagram post and it was four images and it was like the four podcasts that I listened to most of. And, it was yours. It was Gritty Bowman at the time. It was Randy Newberg's, and I'm blanking on the fourth one that I had up there. But I remember you liked it and you messaged me like, or you like commented on it. I was like, oh my gosh, Cody Rich messaged me. Oh, wow. I was such a fanboy.
Oh, that's funny. You know, I feel like we're all that way. You know, I was telling that story. I don't know if it was on the podcast or off about losing the podcast that I did with Remy Warren. And, you know, and I, like, at the time, like, man, that Remy was like this thing, right? And then you become friends with these people and you realize, like, and I think this is very true for life and anything, like anyone you look up. I don't know. The hunting industry to me is really, really small. It's even smaller than most, I would say, like, hobby industries. And even that's no fame, right? Like, even, you know, Steven Ranella puts his pants on the same way you do and like all these things, right? And
yeah, so, but his, like, pants cost a lot more than mine do.
Yeah, probably. but like at the end of the day, like, man, if we put people on a pedestal. And I think there's a lot of people that are scared to reach out to people, to ask for advice, like whatever. And I don't know if it's like just having the confidence to do so, like, will take you to the next level. And this sounds like really cheap, but when you provide value to those people, like, they're willing or, you know, provide value and, or take their advice or whatever. Like, so many people reach out and then not take your advice. And, you know, you're just like, okay, whatever. And don't, fine, go do your thing. Yeah. You know, like, but at the end of the day, like, it's not hard to reach out to people you look up to in business and in hunting or whatever it may be. Like, you know, there's a lot of people, let's take Ryan, for example. Like, you know, Ryan's like this super famous hunter. I love giving him shit for that. But yeah. Like, you know, Ryan's just like a total down to earth dude. You know, it's just like you and I, like, it's not much different, but there's so many people that are like, put him on this pedestal or like you couldn't talk to him or whatever. And I don't know. I just feel like that's not a good way to go through life because it won't help you get ahead.
Well, and if you've ever spent any significant amount of time with Ryan, half of the time he's sitting there on his phone, like individually answering Instagram questions. So, like, you know, again, if people are, if you have reached out to Ryan and heard back, like, to Stealthy Hunter Instagram and have heard back and like gotten advice, That's literally Ryan hanging out in his kitchen while he's drinking his maple syrup coffee, answering those questions. Like, and I feel like that is one thing that's not 100% unique, but is somewhat special about the hunting industry. Is I feel like a lot of these people, the celebrities, the big people, with a few exceptions, are really accessible.
It goes one of two ways. There's people in this industry that get very big headed, and then there's people who are very down to earth. I don't see much middle ground. I see a lot. There's a number of people who think that this is some kind of fame, like the irony there, but like, this is not fame. This is not, you know, 12 people in the country know who you are is not famous.
I don't know, man. I did get recognized at Hunt Expo one time. Wow. That was, you know, I don't know if you realize, but I'm kind of a big deal. I have many leather bound books. My podcast studio smells of mahogany.
Cheap whiskey, not scotch.
Man, it's.
So what should we talk about? What's on your mind?
You know, I'm here in Montana now, and yeah. I'm excited about this year. So I got my first elk.
Yes,
this last
congrats,
year.
Yeah,
that was. You know, it looks like an oversized axis deer.
That's all right, man.
Dude, I am so stoked on that thing.
Though, 350 your bus now or what?
My rule is it just has to be better than last year.
Okay.
So if it's a slightly bigger raghorn, it's a slightly bigger raghorn.
Man, I really don't think, like, I think you should just kill elk for like 5 years. Just every elk, just go.
Well, honestly, like that's my goal. And I have no problem putting down a cow this year too. I was just talking with somebody about this, is I've gotten really used to having meat in the freezer now. And if it comes down to, and I've never been the guy that's like, oh yeah, I'm just a meat hunter. I'm like, no, I want to shoot something big. But I've gotten real used to having meat in the freezer, and I really like cheddar jalapeno brats.
For the record, I think you killed a bigger bull than I did this year.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm dead serious on that. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
It's, it was so freaking awesome though, dude. Like, I'd be happy with that any year. It was with my bow. It was what I've been trying to do for the last, you know, this was my fourth elk season. It's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I mean,
do you feel like some of that stuff clicked for you?
So much. I also didn't realize how loud I am in the woods. And I was out with my buddy, John. I mean, you know, you're probably familiar with John Stallone.
Oh yeah.
I was out with John. I knew when I drew that tag in Arizona, I was like, I called him up. I'm like, hey buddy, guess what we're going to do?
Yeah.
And so of course he's given me some extra shit. Like, you know, I would like bump the tiniest rock and he would turn around and look at me like I just screamed in the middle of the, in the forest, but it was good for me because it did make me a lot more conscious of when I was like being really loud. And a lot of that stuff, it really did click. And it, in a way that, I look at my product, you know, we were just talking about my first hunt. I look at my progression and that first year, I didn't hear anything, didn't see anything, tore both of my knees. It was miserable. Did everything that went wrong, possibly could go wrong, short of like me catching fire, Second year, got into it, finally saw some elk. Didn't really get into them, you know, wasn't really even able to make a stock. The year after that, I got in the middle of elk. I heard them bugling. I got in on them. I got to draw back on them. And then this year, finally got to harvest one.
Yeah.
And
so it's starting to click.
It's progression. And that's what I feel like was super important for me.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted. And I mean, don't get me wrong. Like I said, if that herd bull walked out, that's what I would have wanted. And I would have made that effort. But I can't walk away from this last season
what was
and
the
not
biggest
be happy.
Thing, not to hijack your podcast, but
I love it when you hijack because that means I have to think less.
What's the biggest like aha moment or like aha piece of advice that went from year one to year four, like success? Like we're talking about like putting all the pieces together. And because I think about this sometimes, and the reason I ask these questions, let me just circle back here. The reason I ask these questions is because I've been doing this my entire life. There's things that I didn't consciously recognize in the early years. Now I'm talking to so many people who are in that first phase. I don't really remember that first phase. And so like, it's interesting to go back and be like, okay, here's someone who went through it when they were cognizant of it, where mm-hmm. when I was, you know, nine.
When you're picking it up from family or whatever, yeah. it, you don't, yeah, you don't yeah. recognize that. It's just something they do that you unconsciously pick up.
So like, so coming at it from the adult perspective, adult onset hunter or whatever you call it, like, what are those things that like, you're like, oh man, this clicked. Like, you're like, oh, because quiet's one thing, but I don't feel like that's yeah. the thing.
Well, and so one of the big things was, it's just not committing so deep. Like, you know, I mean, we talked about this. Like, I fell into the romantic trap of elk hunting, listening to way too much Randy Newberg, watching way too many YouTube videos.
Thinking you could go deep.
And, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I probably would have done it differently now. But I don't regret that that happened.
Yeah.
You know, and because I learned a lot, and it taught me some lessons, some really hard lessons, and I also learned a lot about myself. But learning to stay mobile, and that was the big thing I learned in the 2019 season, was just getting out there and trying different spots. And, you know, you don't have, I mean, the spot that I was getting into elk, I could see my truck like from 60% of the places on that hill. Like, I'd do maybe 6 miles a day if I was really canvassing that entire area, maybe. And it was a small piece of land, you know?
This is something that people, you know, they romanticize hunting because they want to be the Ryan Lampiers. You can't be Ryan, you know, say Ryan or I, there was a time where I would hunt 15 miles in, and we graduated to that point. So it takes a certain level of, like, you have to have so many interactions before you can really capitalize on these interactions.
Yeah.
And then when you go in the backcountry, you have very few interactions. We're looking for a particular experience, right? And I think when you're starting out, like, I try to tell people, I'm like, man, you'd have so many more experiences in a week period when you can bounce from different area to different area and you're just getting more at bats. Whereas when you go in the backcountry, like, I may only get one or two. Now, granted, there's a reason I want those one or two.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a different place where, like, testing myself, you know, like, and maybe that's why I don't do it as much. Like, I've found that, okay, I can test myself. Like, I've been through these things. Like, the adventure of it is a piece of it. But when you're just starting out and you don't have a clue even how to get close to an animal or how to find them, or there's so many other pieces that you have to, it's like building a foundation, and everyone wants to go build the attic before they pour the foundation. And it's like, you have to have these like lots and lots of experiences. You have to screw up. You're not going to go in there and be a great elk hunter right out the gate. You have to kind of like screw this up to some degree. Mm-hmm. And I do think like taking these core e-courses and whatnot, that helps. But you're still going to get out there. You could take every course that's out there right now on elk hunting, and you could be an expert.
Oh, and trust me, I did.
And I think there's great pieces to it, but then there's aha moments. And it's like anything. You could read a book, and then all of a sudden the thing that you read the book about happens to you, and it's like the light bulb's like, oh, I get it now. And it's like, that doesn't happen if you just read the book on how to do something. Like, you read a book on how to run a business. Yeah, in theory, you're an expert, right? Until you like get punched in the mouth when you try to start a business,
yeah.
And you're like, this is not exactly what they said, you know? But then all of a sudden, like you realize these problems, and you're like, oh, okay, this is why they said that, or you know, it has a different perspective. Elkin's the same way. Take all the courses, go out there, get punched in the mouth, and realize that it's not as easy as just like, oh, locate bugle, challenge bugle, bull comes in, shoot it. Like, there's some nuance in that, right?
I have. Until this year, there was not a single time where I even got a response to a location bugle in 3 years. And I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not my calling is not exactly above par, but it's good enough to where you would think like something would respond in existence. And I've almost never had that experience. Like, I've not ever had that like bull comes charging in experience. I've gotten some responses like since then, and I did apparently where I do some calling where I was not supposed to, which is considered animal harassment. I do not admit to doing that hypothetically, whatever. That's the only time I've actually called something in. Was I just happened to have like, I mean, you know how it is. You've got like elk calls like sitting around your truck, like one's on the floor, and you're like, I should not put that in my mouth. But
I got in trouble for that one time. I was working in Alaska, and I spent quite a bit of time up there, and we were in a pretty bomber moose location in like September. Anybody knows me, I love calling stuff. So put me in the moose rut in one of the best moose areas in the state and give me 12 hours of boredom. I'm definitely going to go call moose. Right. And then like there's some bird watcher ladies that were found out or something. I was harassing the moose and they told my boss and they tried to get me in trouble. And I was just like, I don't know, not like I was doing anything. I don't know if they thought I was going to poach some moose or something like, or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I've never had that, like that not experience. Even this year? No, like we had a lot of like, it was also like, according to Fishing Game, the worst rut Arizona has seen in 17 years. Of course, the year I draw an Arizona tag randomly, it's terrible. But, you know, we'd get them talking every now and again, but most of the time they were just shy. They'd like pick up their cows and they'd be gone and we were chasing them the whole time. And they would talk in the mornings. And if we could get in on them, we could kind of follow them around, but they were not in a fighting mood.
Yeah.
And, what ended up happening is we kind of got them going and there were some guys down on the road and we weren't in a great spot and we weren't exactly sure where they were, but we knew if we started calling them, they were going to get up and move. Well, these guys happened to be down on the road and they started calling.
Like, perfect.
And it was just like the perfect setup. We wish we could have found them to go thank them for effectively like getting these elk moving towards us and, you know, got in the window. And it was one of those things where I had to make a choice. It was like last day. I mean, I could have hunted some more, but it was my last day with John. You know, it was in the afternoon. So it was kind of getting towards like the end of the day. There wasn't going to be a ton more opportunities. And we're sitting there and we got this perfect funnel. It's like 20 yards, you know, to right where they're funneling through. I got this like window. They can't see me on either side.
No, perfect.
And it was like literally the most perfect setup you could imagine. And, you know, we hear this herd bull. John had got a glimpse of him for a second. He was big and he was 360 plus. And then we have all these cows funneling through. And this herd bull, you hear him and he's screaming and he's moving those cows, but he's not coming in closer. We don't have eyes on him. And I see the raghorn. We knew there was a raghorn there with him. And I see the raghorn coming through. And it's one of those decisions you have to make. You're like, I'm at full draw. And I'm like, do I take it? Do I risk it and wait for the herd bull? Who knows if he's funneling more cows up the other side and he's even going to come up that way. Yeah. And I'm like, always told myself, you know,
it's hard to do. I mean, it's really hard to do when there's a 360 bull in the area. Like, it's so hard to shoot a bull. But, man, I think where you're at, like, don't romance. Don't put yourself on a pedestal for Instagram. Don't put yourself on a pedestal for, like, other hunters. Like, you know, like, just, dude, you got to get kills in your belt. There's so many things that happen in that last, you know, people say they pass bulls, which is funny. like, pass bull or you saw one. It's so, that last little bit is so hard and it's gone so wrong, you know, more times than not, it'll go wrong in that last part. Mm-hmm. So even if you're like, man, I saw this raghorn, like, should I make the last move? And you're like, oh, I'm going to wait for this big bull. Like, you don't learn the thing that happens in that last little bit. And sometimes it's really easy. You know, bull walks out and you shoot him. Sometimes most times it's not, you know, like making that last move, getting that shot, calling, not calling, like. There's a lot of nuance that goes on in like what you call the red zone, right? Like you get within close to the end zone. It's not like you are guaranteed a touchdown by any stretch. Like even under 5 yards, it's not guaranteed a touchdown. Like there's so many things that can go wrong. So I always say like in those early stages, man, just get some kills under your belt.
And that's what it came down to is I was like, I do not want to risk not having this experience.
At the same time, you have that Arizona tag and it's like, but I don't, I mean, I really don't, like, I really wouldn't put much thought into that.
Well, and the thing is, I got after 3 years. Like, it's not like I, it's not like I
10 points.
Burnt 10, 11 points on that or something. Yeah. I burn a whole 3 points. So, okay, 3 years from now, I'll be back where I was and I've got plenty of hunting to do in the meantime.
And the reality is you could do it in different states, man. And that's why I'm huge on like, even if you're new, you should be putting in for multiple states. If you can afford it, do it. There's just better hunting in different places. You could sit there and grind it out on a crappy Colorado over the counter tag your entire life, or 10 years, 5 years, and be like, yeah, elk hunting's tough. I still haven't killed one yet. I talk to people this all the time. People are like, man, I still haven't killed one. I've been doing it for like 6 years. You know, I'm hunting this in Washington. I'm like, stop hunting Washington. Like, you're trying to become a pro NASCAR driver with like a moped.
Why are you not putting in for Montana, like drawing tags in Montana?
No,
oh yeah, that's right. I forgot they got rid of them. They sent them all to Colorado.
They got COVID.
Yeah, that's right. Crap. Forgot about that. Sorry. Californians. Damn Californians coming to Montana.
Idaho? Great hunting. Well, I can't even say that now because you can't get a tag there. Colorado.
I was going to say literally
best state in the country.
In the past, like from when I started hunting, where you could right before season buy an Idaho tag, like you could buy one mid season.
Yeah, you buy your second one.
You could buy your second one, and now, good luck. You know.
Yeah, I think Idaho. I don't want to say it's dead. I am not going to get a tag there. I had one there last year, but.
And I'm gonna pimp some episodes I just released right now. I just released with Hunt and Fool. A series of episodes. We released one, I want to say a week or 2 weeks ago, that is literally like the idiot's guide to the draw.
Oh, nice.
Like all the terms, difference between bonus points and preference points, how different states work. It's everything you need to know if you've never even heard of the big game draw before. And then just released 5 species specific strategy episodes. So we did sheep and goat, we did moose, we did elk, pronghorn, and mule deer. And so those were last 6 episodes I released, and they are all out. And it's not just like for this year. This is like how you build your strategy. Like if you ever want to hunt sheep and goats, this is how you're going to do it. If you want to hunt moose, this is how you're going to do it. This is how you can hunt, you know, build your strategy for elk. This is how you can build your strategy for mule deer, pronghorn. You know, your 1, 3, and 5 year plans, whatever you want to call it, you know.
So I'm curious from like a new hunter perspective, do you think people get overwhelmed?
Oh, it's super overwhelming. I was fortunate in that I am such a researcher that I took my time with that.
Yeah.
And my first year, I almost didn't have the option. I mean, I started in January, so I was a little more focused. Like I put in for kind of the states that everyone tells you you have to put in for, like Arizona, and you know, throw your hat in for New Mexico and a few of those. Like I put in for a few of those, but like I didn't really focus on point building until the next year.
Yeah.
And it was honestly probably good. You know, I miss out on 1 point in a few states, but it focuses me in, and it's super overwhelming. If you don't take it piece by piece, step by step. And
yeah, and it's another thing where I started putting in Idaho, probably first year I hunted Idaho was in 2007. So I researched the crap, and it was like, since I was a kid, researched Oregon. Like I would look at tags, the new tags, like how do I line up? Like, oh, I can hunt these dates. Like I was the nerdiest kid with a synopsis. Like the Oregon hunting synopsis came out and I would read that cover to cover. Like that's how much of a nerd I was. And I'd be like, oh, and I even in like middle school, I had 3 blacktail buck tags and people were like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I remember one of my teachers was like, pulled me aside. He's like, how do you have, it's like, there's no way you can have it. And I was like, no, here's how you do it. And like, that's how nerd I was about this. So then I was like, I found out about Idaho and I was like, man, this is like, you just dive in this whole world. Right. And they had the Idaho hunt planner in like 2007 or 2008. And I would like dive into that. And I was like researching this and that's kind of, then it was like, okay. And then I started, we had property in Nevada. So I started doing Nevada. And then like slowly it was Montana in like 2010, you know, so like I dove in like one state at a time, but once you have 1 or 2 states, it starts to the ball rolling. So I always tell people, like, if you're getting started, because it's easy, like, I don't know if some of your listeners are gonna be like very new. And if you're just getting started, it's like, oh, here's how you put in for, you know, 32 species in 14 different states. And it's like, they overwhelm and don't do anything. So I always say, like, start with one state, like one out of state hunt, and research that. Then maybe the next year go like a little more hog wild, whatever you're comfortable with. Because once you figure out one other state, it's it's similar. It's amazing how crappy these state websites are, though. I just tell my wife, I was doing an Arizona application the other night. I was like, I'm fairly techie. A fairly techie dude. I cannot figure this website out right now because, like, I didn't have, like, I went into the apply and I already bought my license, but the tab wasn't there. And I'm like, and then they're asking for this number. And I'm like, I'm fairly techie when it comes to hunters. I can handle my own. And I can't figure this out. They're losing so much money on this website because, like, people can't figure this out.
Well, and there's so many of them where it's like Arizona, for example, you've got like three different dashboards and you have to log in like to view your preference points. You can view them here, but then you can see your license purchase here, but you can't actually view your license information unless you log into this one.
Yep.
But then you need that to be able to go into this portal. And it's like, and of course we're, you know, it's like, oh crap, I forgot to put in deadlines tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, you suddenly need to do this now.
Yeah. I don't know. Wyoming's that way. I was like, I was trying to figure out how many points I had in Wyoming. I was like, where is this, like a completely different portal? And it was, like, who thought this crap up? Like,
well, and it's such a, I'm sure it's like a history of building on a crap foundation. And until you tear it down, until you tear it down, it's right now it's like, it's like the double wide with the add-on porch and then the weird like little guest house section. And like you're walking through it and it's like there's like weird level differences. And until you tear that down to the foundation and rebuild it or build a different house on the property, it's just going to be like that. And, you know, our as we all know, you know, the federal government, our state agencies are really the models of efficiency, you know, and efficiency with their funds and their money and with how they run things. And there's no bureaucracy. I can't even say the word there at all.
No problems whatsoever.
Absolutely none whatsoever. And so I'm really surprised that their websites are like that. Could you imagine if a private company was able to come in and standardize all of these state, like even with the different rules, but find a way to standardize like the functionality of the websites or even create like a single portal where you could go in and like,
you know, I just feel sorry for the developer that came in and, you know, like, cause they all did this last development. I know exactly how this conversation goes. Right. Cause like the developer comes in and he's like, they're like, hey, we need you to update this piece. And he's like, so I'm gonna have to do all of this. I'm like, no, just this piece. He's like, well, I could do that, but like, you know, this conversation just went sideways out the gate. And then now he's like out there and like we're complaining and he's listening to this like, it's not how I want to do it, guys. It's not.
Stop blaming me.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. It's someday I do have faith that someday it will get a little bit better, but we'll see.
Anyway.
Actually, I was going to say, back to your original question, the one thing I actually was thinking about that really clicked for me this last year was slowing down. Mm. And that ties in with the being quiet, is seeing the speed. Like when I was hunting with John, seeing the speed that he's moving through stuff and getting to places. And like there's times, like especially when you're on a bull, like you're hustling, you're hauling ass. And watching how fast that dude can move quietly is insane to me. I'm like, dear Lord, I'm like a bull in a china shop. But you know, there's definitely times watching how slow he would cover ground and when he'd stop and listen and this and that. And also how faint that dude, my hearing is not that good apparently, but like when he could pick up those bulls and really pull in direction and things like that. That's really what a lot of what I learned and what blew me away. And I know this year I am going to slow down significantly, you know, focusing on my footsteps and just taking my time a lot more as I'm getting to places. Cause that was a big thing when I was here in Montana. And I think I've talked about it before. You know, I was on this piece of state land where it was kind of had a chunk of private that would shoot up in the middle. So you couldn't just like walk straight across it. You had to like
go down around.
You had this one little corner where like that touched the road where you could park. Everything else around it was private. And then you could go in through this corner and then you had to like walk up and over this little ridge and then across and then back up on the ridge to get to the spot where the elk where you would have this small like chunk of time in the morning before the elk would go onto the private and cross like way over. And problem was, like, I got so focused on that's where the elk are that I'm screwed up a lot of opportunities literally 200 yards from my truck.
Yeah.
Where if I had been, and then towards the end, I started preparing myself for that. But then of course they weren't there those times.
Yeah. I don't know. It's really hard to articulate. And I've tried this a few times, but like there's the difference between my fast and my slow is astronomical. It'd be crazy. Like if you didn't have any clue and just like went hunting with me, you'd be like, why are we going so slow? And then also you're like, why are we in such a hurry? And like, it's really hard to articulate that gut feeling of there's nothing here, move fast. Like, because to some degree you're right. I probably move slower than most people and I'm not in a hurry to do things in certain points, but at other points I'm completely comfortable like bombing through areas. And if I know I'm not going to bump anything, like, because I do feel like there's a ton of people that leave the truck and then like all of a sudden they're like sneaking to look for an elk. And it's like, no, there's nothing here. But like, you don't know that, right? So the guy that's new, he's like, okay, do I leave my truck and go really slow? Do I leave my truck and go really fast? And it's like, that is so, so hard to articulate, because there's times where I'll cover miles and miles and miles because I know there's nothing there. How do I know that? I don't know. I just know, right? Or I'm locating it along the way. And so like, man, how do I articulate that to you? Because you're now someone who has seen both sides of that fence.
I don't think it's something you can articulate. I think it is something that's either shown and learned or born of experience. And it's when you're hunting, you have to start off somewhat cautious. Like when you're new to this versus, I think I talked about this with,
I just think there's so many people, and I see them all the time. They're like sneaking through the woods. I'm like, what are you doing? You know, like I just come up on these guys and they're like, they're going so slow. And I'm like, oh, okay, bye. Like, and I don't want to pass these dudes because I have a place to be, you know?
And I think I talked about this a lot with, are you familiar with, Orlando Chiles, Chiles? He pronounces it differently. I think he said it's technically Chiles, but Chiles? He pronounces it Orlando Chiles because
that's how other people do it.
Exactly. But he goes by Buck the Black Hunter on Instagram. Dude, this dude is wild. You have to talk to him. You have to listen to my episode with him.
Okay.
He got into hunting by watching rap videos. He was watching like rap videos online. He's like from like Stockton.
Okay.
And he's like sitting watching rap videos on YouTube. Then all of a sudden like Randy Newberg pops up on his YouTube feed out of nowhere. I'm like, how is that even a thing? And so he like starts watching these Randy Newberg videos and he like gets obsessed.
Really?
He is wild, dude. He is so much like, you watch his Instagram feed and he's like dancing and having a good time. And he's like a black dude with like dreads and
really?
he tells it. He's like, yeah, I get looks in the field that are people like, what are you doing here? Cool guy. Like, you have to listen to my episode. I think Brian's done an episode with him too. But he's such a cool guy. But he and I were talking about that, where do you start your hunt?
Yeah.
Do you start your hunt when you get to your glassing point? Do you start your hunt right when you leave the truck? And, you know, I think there's a happy medium of when you leave the truck for your hunt, yeah, okay, you know, you're 10 feet from the truck. Are you sneaking? Probably not. There needs to be some sort of reasonable amount, but you also need to be aware, be alert the whole time. And then, you know, everything changes. If you are sitting at your truck, you throw out a location bugle and you know, like right where, what you're chasing is, you still want to be aware, but you can probably move with a little bit more purpose. You know, you're not necessarily sneaking the entire time. And I think a lot of that is just built from experience, but we've talked about it where, start your hunt when you leave the truck, but do you need to start sneaking?
Yeah.
No, but be cautious about the noise you're making and be alert. Keep your wits up, because who knows, especially if you're like me and you're happy with any bull and you see and something walks out in front of you because you are being quiet while you're walking through the woods, something happens to walk out in front of you.
To play devil's advocate, if I was looking for any bull, any elk, what is it we're going to call it? You have to, like, elk per square mile are less than you think. Like, dudes walking out in the woods and be like, start sneaking. Like, you aren't going to cover enough miles to even find an elk. Yeah. It's going to take you a week to find one. Where, you know, if I'm like, okay, I got to find elk. Elk are pocket in, like they're herd animals. So they're in pockets, right? And so I tend to just, if I go to a new area, I'm going fast and hard until I find sign. If I find sign, smell elk, see elk, whatever it may be, I'm also fairly confident that if I, depending on where it is, like if it's very tight with private and there's, I don't want to bump them, there are those times where I got to be cautious in that aspect. But by and large, you put me in a new unit, say I draw a Colorado tech, put me in a new unit, I'm covering ground so fast, it's ridiculous. You'd be like, what are we doing? You're going to bump elk. I'm like, I don't care. I'll find them then. I have to find elk to hunt elk. I can't just start still hunting out of the truck. Now, granted, when we go to New Mexico, let's say limited number of elk in an area, you don't want to bump those elk. So I got to be very cautious about that. And so like being reserved in those aspects is like, okay, the first number one plan is go as hard and fast as you can until you find some elk to actually hunt. And then we can slow it down. Maybe that's the way to articulate it.
Well, I think here's the thing too. Like if it's your first day and it depends on how long, if you've got 3 days to hunt, well,
go as hard and fast as you can.
Yeah. You're probably not, you've got a real uphill battle against you there. But like if you've got, a whole season ahead of you, like, say here in Montana, we got a long ass season.
Yeah.
So to some extent, unless you are like dead set on getting one in archery season or whatever it is, or you got other stuff you need to hunt, we got a long time. So you can afford to bump them a few times, especially because there's more square mileage. And if you're in a new unit,
if you're in an area with a lot of elk or a significant portion of elk, if you're not hunting in an area with like one herd of elk,
yeah,
be very cautious. If you're in Idaho and you're like, I'm just looking for an elk, I would go as hard as fast. I used to do this. I used to show up in Idaho and have 3 days to hunt. Man, I would cover every single road till I cut a track. I'd bugle all night long till I found a bugle. Like, no sleep. 3 days, I could probably do it. Like, we're not sleeping, though. Like, yeah, that's not happening. 3 days hard and cover as many miles as you can, get on elk, then slow it down a touch. But again, I don't know if I, it just depends on terrain.
And I have a feeling, too, like, if you're drawing a unit, if you're drawing maybe like a unit that has, like that single herd of elk, and maybe it's especially maybe if it's like a really nice unit or something like that, you've probably also done some I have a feeling a lot of people have done some preseason scouting at that point. They either have cameras or they've done a lot of glassing.
Yeah.
Likelihood is you also have a better idea of where those elk are going to be. Not always. There's so many exceptions to literally everything we're saying right now, but I feel like you draw those prime units, and it's especially like if it's a unit there's one herd of elk, likelihood is you've put in the work to find where that herd is. Versus a lot of what I think we're talking about is like you're bombing into a new unit that's like an over-the-counter tag that's probably got scattered elk, a lot of different places, whatever. You're not looking for an elk. Exactly. And for most of the people that are listening to this podcast, that's like me, that's where they're at. And so... Yeah, you can afford to, especially like right at the beginning, you can afford to bump some elk because you'll find more or they'll be back in the area the next day. Yeah. And now you know where they're at. You know where to slow down.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened on my hunt in 2019. Like I said, I found where they were. I will say that again, though, the one mistake I made is I didn't realize they were coming in some mornings to that area that I was walking through. And so me, I'm just like, tromping through because I'm still half asleep as I'm trying to get out there, get ahead of this herd. And I blew some opportunities that I could have had 300 yards from the truck and had a real nice pack out of some decent sized satellite bolts. But
yeah,
I digress. It's not bitter.
Well, it also changes. You were talking about, slowing it down or different types of areas. So I took one of the Patreons hunting last year when we went to New Mexico, and I explicitly asked him like, hey, what kind of hunt, I don't care. It's up to you. Like, what kind of hunt do you want to do? What do you want? He's like, man, I want to hunt big bulls. He had killed an elk, had a little bit of experience. So he's like, I want to learn how to hunt big bulls. I'm like, okay, it's not gonna be fun, but we can do that. And it's so different because, you want to hunt big bulls. Like, this is the difference. If I go to the same exact unit and it's just me versus, let's say, Sam's like, hey, I drew this tag, come with me. So if these are two, I approach this hunt so differently, right? So we show up a couple days early and I'm glass, 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 trying to find, I just trying to figure it out. Like, I, at e-scouted the crap out of this. We get down there. I'm like, okay, I like what I saw here. Don't like what I saw here. Let's, you know, and I was pretty spot on e-scouting. Like, okay, this is money. Went up, glassed up, shooter bull. Like, we found a giant. That rarely happens. Like, usually we're spending 3 or 4 days to find a shooter bull, right? So we find a shooter bull. And it's like, okay, like now let's play it safe game. So this is so much different. And I would never do it. If you asked me to go take you on an elk hunt in New Mexico and we went the same unit, I would have chose a different area. I would have hunted it completely different. Everything about this hunt is different. And this is why sometimes when people like look at what I'm doing or what Ryan's doing, it's like, this is not what you should be doing. What I am doing is not fun or getting me at bats. I sat on a bull for 5 days straight and I could only hunt him for like a couple hours a day because I couldn't bump him. Like, bumping was an out option. We were 6 miles in, no water, like 90 degree heat. Like, I can't hunt this bull in the morning cause he's shutting up and he's in a good spot where the wind's just,
yeah,
he knows where he's at. Like, he's smart. That is not a great hunt for you to learn how to get elk, how to have a lot of experiences. That hunt is going to, I'm hunting one herd of elk. There is 10 elk with one shooter in it. That is the only elk in the area. That is it. And that hunt is like, I can only hunt them in the evening because the wind's wrong in the morning. That's so different than I'm like, okay, let's go find the most amount of elk in this unit. And then let's go bugle or try to get close because a satellite's going to be totally fine. And there's going to be a lot of bulls working. Like, this is a big bull tucked up on a mountainside with 10 elk and he's got the wind perfect. Like, he's done this before. That's a different hunt than, hey, let's go call bulls. Let's try to get in the most amount of elk, because at the end of the day, like, you just need numbers. You need to like get in the most amount of elk because that's what's going to give you an opportunity. And that's how those are like very different, same unit, you know, just two different approaches. Right. And I really think that most people need to like cover as much ground, have as many at bats as they can, like screw this up, find satellites. You know, you could kill a 350 satellite. Like, there's times where there's plenty of herd bulls, but there could be a giant bull come in and cruise by, or, you know, like, you just don't know.
Well, shoot, this spot I was in here in Montana last year.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, cause I just forget the state names. Yeah. Well, they didn't have it last year, but they have it now. Okay. So they all of these bulls I'm talking about have moved to Idaho and Colorado. But you know, this spot I was in, I mean, there were some good sized satellites. Like, I was actually struggling. Like, when you see them, you'd see them and you'd know, but like, at times I was struggling to find the herd bull. Cause you'd see one, you'd be like, is that, then you'd be like, no, that guy's bigger. And there was like a lot of real nice bulls out there.
Well, you have to understand, man, people get confused about this herd bull term. Like, herd bull is a relative option. Is herd bull the biggest bull in the area? Absolutely not.
Not at all.
Absolutely not. I looked at dozens of herd bulls between, well, it's season open this year. So I got back from New Mexico and I started hunting at 11. So between the 11th and the end of September, I looked at dozens and dozens and dozens of herd bulls that I know for a fact were not the biggest bull in the area. Big bulls hadn't showed up yet. So what's a herd bull? Herd bull is just a bull that's with cows. He could be a satellite tomorrow. I promise you that. You know, there could be a 320 herd bull and a 350 that is there. Is he a satellite? Technically, I've watched 350 satellite bulls follow a herd or just kind of be off a couple hundred yards. So people get this like wrapped in the head, like herd bull is the biggest bull. It is not. I promise you. Most herd, and there are herd bulls that will, the biggest bull in the area will have cows and he'll have them all season. That's more rare. I promise you. That's more rare than the giant that like comes in at night, hangs with cows, leaves, and a 320 like guards those bulls all day. Like, there's so many dynamics to it. It's just weird, you know? And so like, to think like, oh, I'm going to kill a herd bull. Like, you get close to a herd of elk, there are bulls around. There are bulls you're willing to shoot. That's all you need to know, is like, follow the herd, because that's what everyone else is doing. The biggest bulls, sometimes they'll be right there. They're close, but he's not going to be with them in the daylight, or there's no hot cow and he doesn't care. Like, there's so many variables, and people get wrapped up in this, like, after the herd bull. I've more times than not seen the herd bull not be the biggest bull. And so,
yeah,
keep that in mind.
Oh, for sure. And this was kind of like the textbook situation, like they were in. Like, it was very much like,
and that happens,
the big bull, and they were really herded up early in the season. And I mean, this was a huge herd. There was every so often, like a small section would break off. And that's a lot of probably what we're talking about, where one of the quote unquote satellite bulls would take a chunk away or whatever it would happen. But this was definitely like all the cows were bunched up and there was the big bull dead center, you know, dead center of it with the prime view, the cows like all facing out from him. And then there are the satellites fighting around the edges and peeling stuff off.
Yeah, it's very textbook. Like it's how it was supposed to work.
Yeah. And it was really cool. Like it was so cool to finally see that. And I mean, when I finally got to close enough to actually draw, which I misranged and I probably wouldn't have if I'd ranged correctly, I got like a piece of grass that was like 20 yards in front of him that I just, you know, when it's out of focus in the spotter
or your hand's
in
the, doing this,
exactly. And you're in front of like a teeny, like one single tree, the only cover for, and you're like, crap, I got to do about this. That was the experience. Like all the satellites, they were fighting and screaming at each other. And the ones I drew on, it was actually a pair that was like frozen and like all locked up.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was really cool. And they were like 85 yards when I thought they were 65. Yeah. I let that arrow loose and it went and like hit the dirt like 10 yards in front of them, 5-10 yards in front of them. And they both like kind of, you know, they were back and forth and you can't see me gesturing right now. But they were locked up and they're like shaking back and forth. And you see them kind of both like stop. And they kind of, they're still locked up and they kind of glance to the side and look at the arrow and it's like flashing with my nocturnal. And then they're like, whatever. And they go back to fighting. And I'm like, son of a, oh, come on. What was that? And then that's, I rearranged them. And I, like, as they were moving away, I'm like, oh, that could explain why. But it's cool seeing that experience. And I finally, that was what I was looking for a couple of years, was finally getting into them. And, you know, I mean, they were talking that year all night. They wouldn't talk at all during the day, but the second like shooting light was done, I mean, they were screaming and like you could pick out all the different bulls. Like and you know how it is in some locations. Like there's some bulls that they've got that really weird bugle.
Just growl.
This guy, there's one guy, I wanted to see him so bad and I could never, because they wouldn't talk during the day, I could never figure out which one it was. Mm-hmm. But he was, you could tell from like, I mean, he was the most dominant bugler for sure. Yeah. But he had this weird, like, it almost sounded like scales on a piano where he would go like up and down the way he would bugle. And it was so cool. I wanted to figure out which one that was so bad. Just get eyes on him.
I just want to see. Wow. On that Patreon hunt or the New Mexico one we did last year, you know, we hunted big bulls and after 5 or 6 days, I was like, well, you know, what do you want to do? He's like, oh, let's go chase bulls. Like, you know, we tried on this bull, but yeah, I don't want to waste my entire hunt on one bull. Let's go look for it out. So we go out and this other area, wanted to go check out, go in there and man, bulls screaming everywhere. We just kept turning up bull after bull after bull. And like right at dark, we found one good bull, bugle. We never saw him. Yeah, we did see a pretty good, like 350 bull. But this other bull screams and so it's kind of getting dark and like we was listening. I'm like, okay, so we basically just bivvied wherever we were, sleeping bag and a pad, you know, like lay it down. It was pretty nice out, so we lay down and these bulls like basically came towards us a little bit. They're only a few hundred yards and all night just bugle, and I'd wake up every once in a while and kind of, you know, see what was going on and make sure they're still there. All night there's at least three maybe four bulls, you know, just screaming all night. And I was like, sweet, get up, I don't know, half hour before daylight. And it was like quiet. I was like, uh-oh. And I was like, get your stuff. And I was like, you know, thinking they went this way. So we just like start mobbing that way, listening. Pretty soon we could hear them. You know, they started working away. I was like, crap. So like just in the dark, we're just falling. Like, and then man, they're cruising, right? And like, as it's getting daylight, we can see them going up this next ridge. And I was like, frig, man, they're like just checking out on us. And so there was a big canyon that they had crossed. I was like, let's work our way around, and go that way. So we work our way around and you get up there and thinking like, okay, might lose them, might not, who knows. Hear him bugle. Finally just start catching up with him again. It was like, okay. So we like slip in and this bull all night, bugles all night going crazy. And then with his cows all the way up the mountain. And then we circle around and we come out. I never said a word. Because he was just bugling so much. And we pop out and I see cows. It's like money. And they were like feeding it. I can hear him just over the hill. You know, he's behind him quite a ways. And so he's like, slip up, slip up. And we're like, we're pushing it pretty hard. This is like one of the last days we have. And it was like in the view of cows. Like I'm slipping through trees and like, just got to get there. Just got to get there. I get set up 50 yards from where these cows just crossed. And this bull screaming, screaming, screaming. And I see him. And we're like, range him. He's 120, you know. And he's like looking back down the hill, looking back down the hill. He's still screaming. And like he goes behind a tree, and I was like, let's go towards that tree. Let's keep that tree between me and him. And it's pretty open right here. Like it's like sparse juniper. Like we keep that tree and we'll move right at him. We start moving at him, and I can't hear him. I can't hear him. And I was like, then he bugles again. And again, he turned, man, like it was like, I was 50 yards from where he should have went. Mm-hmm. And I started going, and we were 120 yards from him. And I started going down towards him, and we didn't bump or anything. Wind's perfectly in our face. He just starts bugling away. Like he was with those cows all freaking night. Bugles 2 miles at least up the mountain with them, and then just turns and bugles and goes that way. And he just kept bugling. I was like, God, are you kidding me? Right there.
Oh man. I mean, they're wild animals, you know.
Yeah,
you
like never cats.
You can make assumptions based on prior information, and you know, generally they, as a general rule, they act somewhat consistent. You may not know,
they sometimes act like elk,
what their motivations are, but they're a wild animal. You can't ever know what's suddenly gonna. Yeah. You know, you may not have smelled that one wolf that you will never see and never have any thought that it existed in your mind, and that elk could have been like, screw this, I'm out. Or, well, you know, who knows?
The realistic thing that probably happened is, you know, say there's 3 bulls in there. So if one bull came in and they're bugling all night, they're usually locating. And like when they bugle all night like that and it's going crazy and you can tell it's a rut, big bulls are turning their ear up and they'll hear it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times a big bull will come out and loop out, you know, the 5 or 6 cows that had that hot cow in it.
Yeah.
And so you can have a younger bull, you know, herd bull, great example. Herd bull's like going up, you know, this is a younger bull that had them. He started this whole thing. And now he's got all the cows that don't have one in heat. And then they go back up to bed wherever they were. And he, you know, he's all proud of himself, goes up there and he's like, wait a minute, there's no, you know, my hot cow's not here with me. Why am I here again? You know, like who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows what happens, but that happens a lot. It just kind of, that's September. It's chaos and carnage, and
that's why it's so fun.
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome.
I'm excited. I'm interested to see what it's going to be like this year. It's such a weird winter right now.
I know.
I mean, it's what, end of January, and it snowed like 4 times. It's barely even dusted the driveway.
Yeah. You know, I was talking about that with someone else. It's hard to say, man. We could have the worst February of history. You know, granted, I do think we're kind of in a downtrend of hard winters. It's a good thing to think about for Arizona. Like we're kind of in a few years of dry spells. And then, you know, everyone's like, oh, global warming, all this. It's like, well, it could just ebb and flow like it's done for the last 100 years. But
I digress. Farmer's almanac.
But, you know, at the end of the day, most of the elk, it's a good winter because you're not going to have kill off.
Yeah.
We could get the weather in June is far more important than it is in December. You know, I don't think we hold our water like, you know, people assume. And there's our states, but like technically wildfires could be less because you have less vegetation to burn. You know, there's a lot of variables. I think it's very unknown is what I'm getting at.
You could sit and probably postulate all day long, and until we actually see what happens, no one's going to know. And
from the hunting perspective, I'm not worried about it at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Well, and that's kind of what I was thinking, like, and not, you know, if, as long as, you know, coming through February and March, something gnarly storm doesn't blow in, the you know, it's going to be nice in about 3 years with, with everything that's grown up. And
yeah, that affects deer more than elk, but, at the same time, like, you know, we've had years where really, really light winters and heavy springs, like lots of rain. That's where you get like tremendous antler growth.
Yeah, at least they got all that water, and yeah, here in Idaho. I mean, that's one of the interesting things I remember learning and getting super fascinated with is a lot of the times you can see, and you know, not 100% of the time, but you can see a lot of the season reflected in how the antlers grow.
Yeah.
And like where you see, okay, they've got spindly tops, but wide bases or this or that. And a lot of the time, I mean, and again, you know, not 100% of the time, but it can be attributed to a lot of how the season was, you know, the vegetation, the water, the, you know, all of that stuff, you know, when they got their nutrients, and you can see that.
Well, I mean, this gets really in depth. Like the guys are looking for antler size or looking like, okay, how are they going to finish out? Whatnot for new guys, it has to do with water, you know, and for the most part hunting depends on the area, you know, Arizona, Eastern Montana, like the drier states, some of Colorado depends on water. If you're hunting Idaho, the mountainous country of Colorado, most of Wyoming, I say like the west half of Wyoming, what, dude, water is like,
it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. It's more than you think. And elk will water in the smallest little seep. Like it, you can't base it on that. Arizona has something to do with, you know, some of the eastern drier state or eastern part of some states, I should say, that can change. And hunting water can be important.
That was one of the weird things I learned too, is just the kind of water they will actually water at. Cause I think you, when you're first starting, you're learning, you know, you're taking your elk 101 course or whatever, yeah, you know, and you're learning, okay, I got to look for water, and you're e-scouting. And so you're looking for these like very clear, big bodies of water or something.
Yeah, like, oh, look, this lake.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Which is exactly what I did. But then especially when you get in there, you're like, oh, this whole draw is like a lot. I mean, a significant amount of water that, yeah, anything could, you know, like, and you kind of realize and you learn to look then, you know, for those green spots that kind of, yeah, funnel in and things like that. And,
it depends, like New Mexico and parts of Arizona, it's all about tanks, man. Tanks, yeah, tanks, like finding hidden tanks or like, and it's crazy. Like there's tanks that, you know, not on Google Earth or not on anything. So that's where like, man, it matters a lot. Idaho, most of Oregon, like you'd be amazed at how much water, like the littlest creek, you know, like, mm-hmm, you can't even see it. You never see it on Google Earth. Like there are places where you can look on Google Earth and be like, oh, this like green strip obviously means there's water. This, you know, the corn that's burned is green. Why is that? You know, there's things you can figure out, but by and large, like what I grew up trying to figure out and all that, water didn't matter. Not, yeah, a lick.
Well, and it's, I mean, and like you said, in different sections of the state, it's going to vary.
Yeah.
Like even here in Montana, that, or sorry, that spot in Idaho that, that we discussed back in 2019 that I hunted for a while. That was all tanks.
Yeah.
Like there was not a ton of, I mean, there's a few spots, but most of those spots ended up having tanks built,
yeah,
on them because, yeah, they were so, so minimal.
Well, it's cattle country. So, yeah, like, when you get in cattle country, most of the springs are, you know, they don't want the cattle to stomp the spring out. So, they'll protect it or build a tank or, you know, block it off so they can't. Because cows can basically stomp a spring out.
Yeah.
So, they'll just crush it until it doesn't produce water anymore, or it goes underground. So, like, those, you know, cattle country, knowing whether you're in cattle country or not, that matters.
Yeah. So, I want to give you a quick second to pimp the podcast, pimp your Patreon, because I will say I'm gonna lay a little bit of claim to giving you the suggestion for starting that Patreon.
This is true. I forgot about that.
I remember reaching out. We'd been talking, and it was before I came for that visit. We'd been talking about it before that, and you finally told me when I came, and we all went out for sushi.
Mm-hmm.
You were like, I finally did it.
Yeah.
And I remember reaching out. I'm like, dude, you release so much effing content. Why are you not just taking a chunk of them and making them Patreon only? Like, yeah, it's, you're leaving,
well,
money.
You know, people got mad about that. But at the end of the day, so I do a podcast. It's once a week for those who don't know. And we used to do another show. And actually, in the early days, we had Wapiti Wednesday and Muley Monday. We were doing three shows a week from June to October. And it was like, It was really good. It got huge growth for us, but at the end of the day, it was so much work. And I was like done with it. I was like, okay, I started another business and time was an issue. And I was like, let's just get rid of it. And, you had kind of said Patreon, a couple of people mentioned Patreon. I was like, okay, let's throw these Wapiti Wednesday, Muley Monday episodes on Patreon. Let's structure them throughout the year so it's not so much work on us. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, like, we'll just get rid of it. Like, that was the original plan anyway. And it worked really well. You know, there's tons of people who are bad about it, but like at the end of the day, it was like, okay, this is the only thing that's scalable for that I would do. So it was like, it was either this or it goes away. Like, I don't really care if you guys wanted it. But no, it's fun. And so we do have our Patreon side. And I look at Patreon, like, it's funny. We talk about courses and there's tons of great information out there. I look at Patreon almost as like continuing education, because weekly we put out an episode based on elk or mule deer. And I dive into tips and tactics and things like that. And so it's, I consider it continuing education based on your coursework. but yeah, anyway, we do that in the podcast. So if people want to check that out.
Yeah, definitely. Where can they find all that?
On the internet. That's where we put the podcasts. Anywhere podcasts are produced, I guess, or distributed, I should say. But yeah, Patreon's kind of the exclusive Wapiti Wednesday show. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of elk specific. I should say mule deer too, because we do a mule deer show as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been good.
Do you do the Tag Tuesdays on there, or are those on the main feed? Or do you still do those?
Don't still do them. We did. So I should say.
Slacker.
Well, dude, you know how it is. we actually, so this, the first 3 months, generally speaking, our Wapiti Wednesday is guests, and we do, you know, stories, tactics, those things, like very high level, like 301 stuff. The first quarter of 2021, last year we did these biology series, and Jaden was interviewing different biologists from different states and doing all that. Those are really popular. So we're going to continue that. And I'm going to do basically elk tag stuff, draw stuff, whatnot for deer and elk. And Jaden's going to be doing biology series. So for the next 3 months, we have like hardcore biology series and hardcore tag application stuff for different states. We just did two with Robert Hanneman talking about like our favorite elk states, what we like, what we don't like, all these things. So
yeah, you recorded one with him, I think an hour before you recorded one of our species episodes.
That's awesome. Yeah.
It was funny. We were just talking about that. Who did I, somebody else, was it Laura? Did you record one with Laura Zero recently? I got a call from her. She's like, hey, I've got to go record a podcast with this guy in Bozeman. And then I'm going to stop by. Let's hang out. So, and we were talking and she's like, yeah, it was like just up the road. I'm like, oh, are you going to record with Cody? And she's like, yeah.
That's funny.
She's good. She's good people too. That was a fun podcast to record.
Yeah, that's funny.
She's actually got me all into like knife forging now. I'm literally probably going to go home and I should have some packages waiting for me.
Nice.
So I can this weekend start
forging knives,
because I totally need another hobby.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems legit.
Absolutely.
Something to take your time up.
Exactly. awesome, man. All right. So final thought, somebody comes up to you, I've asked you this question before, but somebody comes up to you, maybe they've heard the podcast once or twice, or just, you know, see you wearing some first light gear or whatever it happens to be. And they're like, hey man, you know, I know you hunt, like I've always wanted to get into this, but like I have zero background in it. I don't know, man. I don't even know where to start. It's a little intimidating. Maybe I shouldn't do it. Like what advice would you give that person?
I'd be curious what my answer was before, but I will say start small, find someone someone who speaks your language, and like whether it's Ryan, whether it's you, whether it's me, whether it's Randy, and like start just going down that rabbit hole, watching content, whatever. Get yourself a tag. Go on your first hunt. Don't try to go out and go 20 miles in the backcountry.
Don't go on a DIY solo archery elk hunt.
Or do whatever. but I would say start small. I always push people to Mark Livesay's e-scouting course. I feel like that's step one. And then, you know, like the Elk Collective. I do think some of these online resources are amazing, whether it's like Elk 101 or the Elk Collective or Mark's e-scouting course. Like take some of those courses, man.
Which I think it's code TWI. It's either code TWI or TWI20 or something I think you can get like $20 off Livesay's course. And I did an episode. I think we've all got an episode with Livesay or two under our belts. Yeah. And that's one of my more popular episodes, because that dude has some.
He's a wealth of knowledge for sure.
Wealth of knowledge.
I, you know, and maybe that's overwhelming. I don't know. Like, is that too much for like the new guy?
You know, I don't think so, because he lays it out so clean. And if you are, because he doesn't lay it out, it's not like you're sitting listening to Rand, you're like, I need to go 20 miles in. He's like, no, he's like, decide how far you're willing to hike.
Yeah.
Take a compass and make a circle, a bunch of circles around the trail. You know, and he goes through that, and it scales. I think that's why it's beneficial for anyone, because it scales. Like if you can hike 14 miles in a day, good on you. You can plan for that.
Yeah.
If all you want to hike is 3 to 4 miles, then make, you know, adjust that circle. And it scales. I think it's a lot of information, but if you're like a researcher kind of person, it's super valuable. And
that's huge. You know, I think, you know, going down the rabbit hole, like listen to some podcasts, try to find one. The thing is, you can be overwhelmed with information. So that's why I always say, try to find like one thing that you start out with. If you were to, like my podcast, like our Wapti Wednesdays are so elaborate that sometimes I think it's overwhelming to people.
Yeah.
And like, I'll talk to multiple guests and have multiple ideas, multiple approaches, multiple tools for your toolbox. I almost say don't start with my podcast, because like it can be like, well, you said to do this, you said to do this. Like my, like they're like Elk 101's good at like, here's how to step it out, right? Mm-hmm. But then it gets so much bigger than that. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then like, you know, I feel like the Elk Collective has more information on multiple ways, but I don't want to confuse people. That's why I say going to my podcast may confuse you, because it's like very 301 sometimes. And I don't want people to just like, whoa, crap, I don't know what to do now.
Well, and that's one of the things, like when I started listening, I did not understand half the crap that was going down. Like, oh my gosh, I made the mistake of starting to listen to Jay Scott's podcast when I first started. And I'm like, I don't get what's going on. Like, cause he gets technical, real technical sometimes.
Yeah. He'll get so deep into a unit that has three tags, and you're like, I don't know why this is applicable to anyone, but like the three people that own that tag.
But the one thing I did learn from listening to yours, listening to Brian, like all this stuff was terms to look up, things to research. And then I was just absorbing it. It was literally, you know, I mean the term drinking from the fire hose, like you just kind of take what you can absorb. Yeah. And don't stress about having to pick up every single nuance.
Would you say going on a guided hunt for your first hunt is beneficial?
Oh, absolutely. I would super recommend that.
People have asked that
question.
I don't really know the answer.
I mean, if you can afford it, because it's not cheap. Yeah. Like, let's face it. I mean, you can find inexpensive methods. And you know, especially like, you know, not pimping out Hunt and Fool or anything, but like, I just think the service is valuable. They can help you with stuff like that. Yeah. They can help you build a plan. They simplify things. And they can help you find an inexpensive guided hunt for whatever your goal is. There's another thing. I just did a podcast, and the FTW Ranch out in Texas, they do this. It's like a beginning hunters program. And I'm actually going to go out towards the end of February and do it. They invited me out. They take you, and I've wanted to do something like this, like organize it. And I didn't even know they were doing it. Literally from like, I've never touched a gun before to I'm cooking a meal from the wild game that I just shot. And they take you out. It's like a 4-day course. They train you on shooting. They train you on gun safety, all of this stuff. Then they talk to you about hunting, and then they take you out on the ranch, and you have to buy a tag, but you can shoot like they've got a few different animals, and they teach you how to glass, and you can shoot a doe or
we should probably pimp. You saying this and it like reminds me of the hunting summit.
And then hunting summit. I was gonna bring that up too. I feel like it's almost like this connects with hunting summit, because hunting summit can be a little more advanced. Like I feel like anyone can benefit from it, but
if you're brand new,
it's overwhelming for sure. But then you go out and they bring someone out. They teach you how to process it, package it up, and then there's a big wild game meal at the end of every day. And
I think the one thing I'll say is that like people underestimate how short hunting season is, and it's like the test. Like you have all year to prep for this test, and don't think of it as like, I'm going to get into hunting in the first year. I'm just going to go and see what it's like. That's an approach. but like there's so much you need to know before that test, because this test is really expensive, and there's so many limited experiences.
Well, I mean, and take opportunities to, I've had a ton of people say this, go on, you know, you don't have to hunt to learn.
Yeah.
Go on a hunt with someone. I mean, shoot, somebody tells me like they're going to help me wear a pack and help me pack stuff out. As long as they know how to shut up, like
another good one. You could go like, I always say this when he books out. My buddy Tony Lombardi does pig hunts in California that are like one day. And like, that's a really, really cheap one day, like experience with a guide. And he's such a good dude. And like he probably doesn't want me to say this, but like he'll teach you so much. And I know that's not his job, but at the end of the day, like you're going with a dude that's like knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. It's solid. It's a one day hunt. It's like $150. Like
I get
so
a lot
cheap.
Of people that ask me about like, hey, do you know this one? And I mean, I know a few people that do stuff like that. Most of them are like my friends that are just like have offered to take me out. They don't really do that.
I know people ask me all the time. I don't know very many guys. Like Tony's the only guy I know.
Especially for pig hunts in California, a lot of people ask me about that stuff, and I'm like, I've actually never hunted pig in California.
You should go on a hunt with Tony.
I mean, do that now. Yeah. It's all expensive for me.
Yeah, that's true.
Right now, I'm a man without a hunting home. I have to wait until like April until I get my resident license here. I'm officially an no longer a Californian. Yeah. I'm trying to forget that part of my life. No.
Yeah, maybe you don't want to go back and hunt California.
Oh man, I don't know. It's got some good hunting, but awesome, man. Well, make sure y'all check out the Rich Outdoors podcast.
Yeah, appreciate it, man.
Check out Backcountry Fuel Box too.
Oh yeah, that thing.
I've got a lot of I'm pimping out your stuff. You're supposed to be doing this. I love
it. I'm not
good
at promoting myself. I don't know if you've ever noticed that about me.
I will admit I do not subscribe anymore because I've kind of figured out what I like. Yeah. But I mean I subscribed to that box for quite a few months, and not all, but a good, I'd say probably 50% of the like snacks and stuff I take into the backcountry, I learned about through the Backcountry Fuel Box subscription, picked stuff out, found what I liked and went from there.
Heck yeah, man.
So Backcountry Fuel Box, Rich Outdoors podcast, link to all of that nonsense on the show notes page.
Well, I appreciate it, buddy.
Of course, man. I appreciate you taking the time, and we're using your like fancy equipment here.
I don't know, it's fancy.
Everyone's probably like, oh my gosh, the podcast sounds so good. Awesome, man.
Alrighty.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com. Get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. That'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this podcast inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher, and head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from the Wild Initiative family, and more.